Chapter 3. If you were to take a plastic bag and place it inside a large bowl, and then, using a wooden spoon, stir the bag around and around the bowl, you could use the expression "a mixed bag" to describe what you had in front of you. But you would not be using the expression in the same way I am about to use it now. Although a mixed bag sometimes refers to a plastic bag that has been stirred in a bowl, more often it is used to describe a situation that has both good parts and bad parts. An afternoon at a movie theatre, for instance, would be a mixed bag if your favourite movie were showing, but if you had to eat gravel instead of popcorn. A trip to the zoo would be a very mixed bag if the weather were beautiful, but all of the man and woman eating lions were running around loose. And for the Baudelaire orphans, their first few days with the squalors were one of the most mixed bags they had yet encountered, because the good parts were very good, but the bad parts were simply awful. One of the good parts was that the Baudelaires were living once more in the city where they were born and raised. After the Baudelaire parents had died, and after their disastrous stay with Count Olaf, the three children had been sent to a number of remote locations to live, and they sorely missed the familiar surroundings of their hometown. Each morning, after Esme left for work, Jerome would take the children to some of their favourite places in town. Violet was happy to see that her favourite exhibits at the Verne Invention Museum had not been changed, so she could take another look at the mechanical demonstrations that had inspired her to be an inventor when she was just 2 years old. Klaus was delighted to revisit the Akhmatova bookstore, where his father used to take him as a special treat to buy an atlas or a volume of the encyclopedia. And Sunny was interested in visiting the Pincus Hospital, where she was born, although her memories of this place were a little fuzzy. But in the afternoons the three children would return to 667 Dark Avenue, and it was this part of the Baudelaire situation that was not nearly as pleasant. For one thing, the penthouse was simply too big. Besides the 71 bedrooms, there were a number of living rooms, dining rooms, breakfast rooms, snack rooms, sitting rooms, standing rooms, ballrooms, bathrooms, kitchens, and an assortment of rooms that seemed to have no purpose at all. The penthouse was so enormous that the Baudelaire orphans often found themselves hopelessly lost inside it. Violet would leave her bedroom to go brush her teeth and not find her way back for an hour. Klaus would accidentally leave his glasses on a kitchen counter and waste the whole afternoon trying to find the right kitchen. And Sunny would find a very comfortable spot for sitting and biting things and be unable to find it the next day. It was often difficult to spend any time with Jerome, simply because it was very difficult to find him amid all the fancy rooms of their new home, and the Baudelaire scarcely saw Esme at all. They knew she went off to work every day and returned in the evenings, but even at the times when she was in the apartment with them, the three children scarcely caught a glimpse of the city's sixth most important financial adviser. It was as if she had forgotten all about the new members of her family, or was simply more interested in lounging around the rooms in the apartment rather than spending time with the three siblings. But the Baudelaire orphans did not really mind that Esme was absent so often. They much preferred spending time with one another, or with Jerome, rather than participating in endless conversations about what was in and what was out. Even when the Baudelaire stayed in their bedrooms, the three children did not have such a splendid time. As he had promised, Jerome had given Violet the bedroom with the large wooden bench, which was indeed perfect for keeping tools, but Violet could find no tools in the entire penthouse. She found it odd that such an enormous apartment would not have even a socket wrench or one measly pair of pliers, but Esme haughtily explained, when Violet asked her one evening, that tools were out. Klaus did have the squalor library next to his bedroom, and it was a large and comfortable room with hundreds of books on its shelves. But the middle Baudelaire was disappointed to find that every single book was merely a description of what had been in and out during various times in history. Klaus tried to interest himself in books of this type, but it was so dull to read a snooty book like Boots Were in 1812, or Trout, in France, They're Out, that Klaus found himself spending scarcely any time in the library at all. And poor Sonny fared no better, a phrase which here means also became bored in her bedroom. Jerome had thoughtfully placed a number of toys in her room, but they were the sort of toys designed for softer-toothed babies. Squishy stuffed animals, cushioned balls, and assorted colourful pillows, none of which were the least bit fun to bite. But what really mixed the Baudelaire bag was not the overwhelming size of the squalor apartment, or the disappointments of a tool bench without tools, a library without interesting books, or non-chewable items of amusement. What really troubled the three children was the thought that the Quagmire triplets were undoubtedly experiencing things that were much, much worse. With every passing day, their worry for their friends felt like a heavy load on the Baudelaire's shoulders, and the load only seemed heavier because the squalors refused to be of any assistance. "I'm very, very tired of discussing your little twin friends," Esme said one day, as the Baudelaires and the squalors sipped aqueous martinis one evening in a living room the children had never seen before. "I know you're worried about them, but it's boring to keep blabbing on about it." "We didn't mean to bore you," Violet said, not adding that it is terribly rude to tell people that their troubles are boring. "Of course you didn't," Jerome said, picking the olive out of his fancy glass and popping it into his mouth before turning to his wife. "The children are concerned, Esme, which is perfectly understandable. I know Mr. Poe is doing all he can, but maybe we can put our heads together and come up with something else."
"I don't have time to put my head together," Esme said. "The inn auction is coming up, and I have to devote all of my energy to making sure it's a success."
"The inn auction?" Klaus asked.
"An auction," Jerome explained, "is a sort of sale. Everyone gets together in a large room, and an auctioneer shows off a bunch of things that are available for purchase. If you see something you like, you call out how much you'd be willing to pay for it. That's called a bid. Then somebody else might call out a bid, and somebody else, and whoever calls out the highest price wins the auction and buys the item in question. It's terribly exciting. Your mother used to love them. I remember one time—"
"You forgot the most important part," Esme interrupted. "It's called the inn auction because we're selling only things that are in. I always organize it, and it's one of the most smashing events of the year."
"Smashy?" Sonny asked.
"In this case," Klaus explained to his younger sister, "the word smashing doesn't mean that things got smashed up. It just means fabulous."
"And it is fabulous," Esme said, finishing her aqueous martini. "We hold the auction at Veblen Hall, and we auction off only the innest things we can find. And best of all the money goes to a good cause."
"Which good cause?" Violet asked. Esme clapped her long nailed hands together with glee.
"Me! Every last bit of money that people pay at the auction goes right to me. Isn't that smashing?"
"Actually, dear," Jerome said, "I was thinking that this year, perhaps we should give the money to another good cause. For instance, I was just reading about this family of seven. The mother and father lost their jobs, and now they're so poor that they can't even afford to live in a one-room apartment. We might send some of the auction money to people like them."
"Don't talk nonsense," Esme said crossly.
If we give money to poor people, then they won't be poor anymore. Besides, this year we're going to make heaps of money. I had lunch with 12 millionaires this morning, and 11 of them said they were definitely going to attend the inn auction. The 12th one has to go to a birthday party. Just think of the money I'll make, Jerome. Maybe we could move to a bigger apartment.
But we just moved in a few weeks ago, Jerome said. I'd rather spend some money on putting the elevator back in use. It's very tiring to climb all the way up to the penthouse.
There you go, talking nonsense again, Esme said. If I'm not listening to my orphans babble about their kidnapped friends, I'm listening to you talk about out things like elevators. Well, we have no more time for chit-chat in any case. Gunther is stopping by tonight, and I want you, Jerome, to take the children out for dinner.
Who is Gunther? Jerome asked.
Gunther is the auctioneer, of course, Esme replied. He's supposed to be the innest auctioneer in town, and he's going to help me organize the auction. He's coming over tonight to discuss the auction catalog, and we don't want to be disturbed. That's why I want you to go out to dinner and give us a little privacy.
But I was going to teach the children how to play chess tonight, Jerome said.
No, 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 Esme said. You're going out to dinner. It's all arranged. I made a reservation at Café Salmonella for 7 o'clock. It's 6 o'clock now, so you should get moving.
You want to allow plenty of time to walk down all those stairs. But before you leave, children, I have a present for each of you. At this, the Baudelaire children were taken aback, a phrase which here means surprised that someone who was so selfish had purchased gifts for them. But sure enough, Esme reached behind the dark red sofa she was sitting on and brought out 3 shopping bags that had the words "In Boutique" written on them in fancy curly script. With an elegant gesture, Esme handed a bag to each Baudelaire.
"I thought if I bought you something you really wanted," she said, "you might stop all this chatter about the quagmires."
"What Esme means," Jerome added hurriedly, "is that we want you to be happy here in our home, even when you're worried about your friends."
"That's not what I mean at all," Esme said, "but never mind.
Open the bags, kids."
The Baudelaires opened their presents, and I'm sorry to say that the shopping bags were mixed bags as well. There are many, many things that are difficult in this life, but one thing that isn't difficult at all is figuring out whether someone is excited or not when they open a present. If someone is excited, they will often put exclamation points at the ends of their sentences to indicate their excited tone of voice. If they say, "Oh!" for instance, the exclamation point would indicate that the person is saying, "Oh!" in an excited way, rather than simply saying, "Oh!" with a comma after it, which would indicate that the present is somewhat disappointing.
"Oh," Violet said as she opened her present.
"Oh," Klaus said as he opened his.
"Oh,"
Sunny said as she tore open her shopping bag with her teeth.
"Pinstripe suits. I know you'd be excited," Esme said. "You must have been mortified the last few days walking around the city without wearing any pinstripes. Pinstripes are in, and orphans are in, so just imagine how in you'll be when you orphans are wearing pinstripes. No wonder you're so excited."
"They didn't sound excited when they opened the presents," Jerome said, "and I don't blame them. Esme, I thought we said we'd buy Violet a toolkit. She's very enthusiastic about inventing, and I thought we'd support that enthusiasm."
"But I'm enthusiastic about pinstripe suits, too," Violet said, knowing that you should always say that you are delighted with the present, even when you don't like it at all. "Thank you very much."
"And Klaus was supposed to get a good almanac," Jerome continued. "I told you about his interest in the International Dateline, and an almanac is the perfect book to learn all about that."
"But I'm very interested in pinstripes," said Klaus, who could lie as well as his sister when the need arose. "I really appreciate this gift."
And Sonny, Jerome said, was going to be given a large square made of bronze. It would have been attractive and easily biteable.
Hey, Jim,
Sonny said. She meant something along the lines of, I love my suit, thank you very much, even though she didn't mean it one bit. I know, we discussed buying those silly items, Esme said, with a wave of her long-nailed hand. But tools have been out for weeks, almanacs have been out for months, and I received a phone call this afternoon informing me that large bronze squares are not expected to be in for at least another year. What's in now is pinstripes, Jerome. And I don't appreciate your trying to teach my new children that they should ignore what's in and what's out. Don't you want what's best for the orphans? Of course. Jerome sighed. I hadn't thought of it that way, Esme. Well, children, I do hope you like your gifts, even though they don't exactly match up with your interests. Why don't you go change into your new suits and we'll wear them to dinner? Oh, yes, Esme said. Cafe Salmonella is one of the innest restaurants. In fact, I think they don't even let you eat there if you're not wearing pinstripes, so go change. But hurry up. Günther is due to arrive any minute. We'll hurry, Klaus promised. And thank you again for our gifts. You're very welcome, Jerome said with a smile. And the children smiled back at him, walked out of the living room, down a long hallway, across a kitchen, through another living room, past four bathrooms, and so on, and so on, and so on, eventually finding their way to their bedrooms. They stood together for a minute outside the three-bedroom doors, looking sadly into their shopping bags. I don't know how we're going to wear these things, Violet said. I don't either, Klaus said, and it's all the worse knowing that we almost got presents we really want.
Puictual,
Sonny agreed glumly. Listen to us, Violet said. We sound hopelessly spoiled. We're living in an enormous apartment. We each have our own room. The doorman has promised to watch out for Count Olaf, and at least one of our new guardians is an interesting person, and yet we're standing here complaining. You're right, Klaus said. We should make the best of things. Getting a lousy present isn't really worth complaining over, not when our friends are in such terrible danger. We're really very lucky to be here at all.
Chittle,
Sonny said, which meant something like, that's true. We should stop complaining and go change into our new outfits. The Baudelaire stood together for another moment and nodded resolutely, a phrase which here means tried to make themselves stop feeling ungrateful and put on the suits. But even though they didn't want to seem spoiled, even though they knew their situation was not a terrible one at all, and even though they had less than an hour to change into the suits, find Jerome, and walk down all those hundreds and hundreds of stairs, the three children could not seem to move. They simply stood in front of their bedroom doors and stared into their bags from the inn boutique. Of course, Klaus said finally, no matter how lucky we are, the fact remains that these pinstripe suits are entirely too big for us. Klaus spoke the truth. It was a truth that might help you understand why the Baudelaires were so disappointed with what was in their bags. It was a truth that might help you understand why the Baudelaires were so reluctant to go into their rooms and change into their pinstripe suits. And it was a truth that became even more obvious when the Baudelaires finally went into their rooms and opened their bags and put on the gifts that Esme had given them. It is often difficult to tell if a piece of clothing will fit you or not until you try it on, but the Baudelaire children could tell the instant they first looked into the shopping bags that these clothes dwarfed them by comparison. The expression dwarfed by comparison has nothing to do with dwarves, who are dull creatures in fairy tales who spend their time whistling and cleaning house. Dwarfed by comparison simply means that one thing seems small when compared to another thing. A mouse would be dwarfed by comparison with an ostrich, which is much bigger, and an ostrich will be dwarfed by comparison with the city of Paris. And the Baudelaires were dwarfed by comparison with the pinstripe suits. When Violet put the pants part of her suit on, the legs of the suit stretched much, much farther than the legs of her body, so it was as if she had two huge noodles instead of feet. When Klaus put the jacket part of his suit on, the sleeves fell far, far past his hands, so his arms looked as if they had shrunk up inside his body. And Sunny's suit dwarfed her so much by comparison that it was as if she had pulled the covers over her in bed instead of changing her clothes. When the Baudelaire stepped back out of their bedrooms and met up again in the hallway, they were so dwarfed by comparison that they scarcely recognized one another. "You look like you're skiing," Klaus said, pointing at his older sister's pant legs. "Except your skis are made of cloth instead of titanium alloy. You look like you remembered to put on your jacket but forgot to put on your arms," Violet replied with a grin. Sunny shrieked, and even her two siblings couldn't understand what she was saying from beneath all the pinstripe cloth. "Goodness, Sunny," Violet said, "I thought you were a lump in the carpet. Here, we better just tie one of the sleeves of the suit around you. Maybe tomorrow we can find a pair of scissors and..." Sunny interrupted. "Oh, don't be silly, Sunny," Klaus said. "We've seen you in your underwear hundreds of times. One more time won't matter." But Klaus was wrong. He wasn't wrong about the underwear. If you are a baby, your family will see you in your underwear many times, and there's no use being embarrassed about it. But he was wrong in thinking that by saying, Sunny had been complaining about getting undressed in front of her siblings. Sunny's oversized suit had muffled the word she was really saying, and it was a word that still haunts me in my dreams as I toss and turn each night. Images of Beatrice and her legacy filling my weary, grieving brain. No matter where in the world I travel, and no matter what important evidence I discover. It is necessary once more to use the expression dwarfed in comparison in order to refer to what happened after Sunny said that fatal word out loud. For even though Violet and Klaus could not hear what Sunny had said, they learned instantly what their sister had meant. For as Sunny uttered the word, a long shadow was cast over the Baudelaires, and they looked up to see what was blocking the light. And when they looked, they felt everything about their lives become dwarfed in comparison to how trapped they felt. Because this word, I'm sorry to say, was Olaf.
End of Disc 1.